Welcome to Over the Rainbow, a safe space and voice for all queer identities. I'm your host, Rachel Keithley, and I use she, her pronouns. Every other Wednesday, we bring you new episodes dedicated to queer education, representation, and activism. I always like my guests to introduce themselves, so do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Hello, my name is Nayla. My pronouns are she, her. I'm not sure what else to say, actually. I run a therapy page with my wife called The Love Brunch by Monet, and I am a couples therapist.
Amazing. That's a great introduction.
Thank you. So I am Monique Logan. I work in a very corporate role for a pharmaceutical organization. My pronoun is she, her, and I am involved, very much involved in a partner with Nayla with The Love Brunch.
Perfect. Well, it's great to have you on the show. And
thank you so much.
You're welcome. Today, we're going to be talking, I guess, about your job area of expertise. We're going to be talking about LGBTQ plus mental health and experiences of shame. But before we get into that, let's quickly share something we've done this week to engage in queer education or activism. All right. So this week, I'm taking some diversity, equity and inclusion training offered by one of my many jobs. I did previously do some training last year with the University of South MoMA, Florida, I think that was its title. But I'm really excited to further this knowledge regarding DEI strategies, because I am a firm believer that it isn't just the responsibility of CEOs or managers. You know, DEI should be embedded at every level of business. So I'm hoping to potentially learn some new strategies that I can implement across all my work environments.
Cool. Okay, that's really wonderful, actually. I love that. It's quite a mouthful as well. I haven't done anything per se this month. However, I did last month, and I've been doing it for the last couple of months. I've been running a drop-in therapy session workshop at the Glass House in Brick Lane for queer bodies who are perhaps interested in therapy, but maybe they don't know how to go about it. So we've been running 20-minute free sessions where you can come along, talk with me. We can sometimes even focus on something that you have a concern with, as well as explore how therapy might be helpful to you. The purpose of that is usually queer bodies find it very difficult engaging with therapy because of identity. They feel that their needs are often not understood. They feel sometimes that emotionally their feelings are never validated. So we're trying to change the narrative and normalize this idea that it's safe enough for you to come and talk to a therapist and to be, you know, understood. So yeah, that's what I did last month and the month before. And I certainly will be doing it later on sometime this month.
Oh, that's so powerful. I love that. And the fact that you mentioned Glasshouse, I love it there. Aisha showed me around last year and I was like, This is the best place.
Great. It is great. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, let's get on with the show. So, to start with, I said we were going to explore LGBTQ plus mental well-being and experiences of shame. So to start with, can you tell me a little bit about what is shame and in what ways do queer folk experience shame?
Shame is often, I would describe, a feeling produced out of a lack of understanding of difference, or sometimes as well, difference that is socially othered because it is not accepted by, you know, our patriarchal constructs or the ruling, the dominant ruling class, and therefore bodies are made to feel less than. And that can sometimes be through body shaming, trans shaming, fat shaming. There's so many different variations of it, but it makes a person feel less than, dehumanized, alienated from society, and very much an outsider.
I think that's a great explanation, and that's really resonates with myself and my PhD work. I know we were talking about it before we started recording, but one of the biggest impacts of online hate on LGBTQ plus people is that feeling of shame, which internalizes as self-blame for being different in some way and for not fitting into that hetero cisgender norm.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think also there is an element of shame within the LGBTQI plus community that we don't talk about openly, where we sort of use our successes as a way to make others feel less than within themselves, and to also make them feel less than for not having any more to contribute to the conversation. And that in turn produces those feelings of lack. So although we are looking outside of the community for people to kind of see us and to respect us, I think we still need to do a bit of work within the community, unpacking some of those ideologies associated with the shame that we project on other bodies. And I don't necessarily know if we're always aware that we're doing it and how harmful, you know, the affects of that could be.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, actually. And a place I see it in is sort of making those upward and downward comparisons in terms of people's activism work. It's like, are you doing enough for our community? Because you're not here with a mic at the front of a rally. And it's like, well, not everyone can do that job. And there are so many other ways to be valuable to our community.
Absolutely. I was having a really cool conversation with a friend a few weeks ago, and we were talking about that same said thing, about this idea of, you know, if I'm not sort of recording and posting it on social media, what I'm doing, that naturally, that sort of equates to, well, I'm not doing enough. But actually, there's so many things that people do within the community that isn't made public, because to some degree, it doesn't really matter on that platform. What it matters to are the bodies who are being directly impacted by it, right?
That's a very good question. I actually think that question is not one answer, can't be given to that question. It's very, very layered, in that I think within the queer community, shame stems from a materialistic type of elements, such as brands, from a what you wear, what you look like. There's shame around bisexuality within the community. There's such an intersection with shame. It's events. You know, are the in crowd or the out crowd? It's just so multi-layered. So, what is shame for me? It's our inability to accept differences within a community where we should be able to embrace those differences, and actually difference in socioeconomic structures. You know, I think we have a culture, which Nayla talks quite a lot about, in kind of cis popularity, she's coined it. And this is all around, are you invited to the latest event? And if you're not, then you're sort of an out crowd. You know, who are the gays and who are the lesbians of the community, and which hierarchy do you sit in? And I think shame is quite, is so much broader and so much more than just, you know, are you making somebody feel bad about what they're wearing and how, you know, how they might behave? It's this culture of calling out. You know, we don't call in anymore, we call out, and we call out quite publicly. You know, shame is something we do to each other on social media. It's just such a broad topic, saying, you know, what is shame? It's just so broad. And I think as a community, if we can embrace the differences that we proclaim that we have within our community, I think we would experience a lot less shame.
Yeah, absolutely. I think adding to that, there's something about calling out our shameful ways of treating other people, and actually giving language to the behavior, and giving language to normalizing conversation around shame not being okay, and shame being this thing that is quite diminishing and dismissive of bodies. And as Mon was saying, you know, that we have, I've called it this cis popularity, in the sense of cis being this this thing that is regarded as what we should do within the dominant ruling class. Well, cis popularity is similar to that, where it's a particular behavior that bodies subscribe to, but that produces shame. for the other bodies who can't sort of emulate to that status. So it's almost like a classification within the LGBTQI plus community that in turn produces and reproduces shame. Because if I am not good enough to step into this circle, how should I then feel about my body? How should I then feel about myself? I am bisexual, but yet I am told that that is not good enough and I should be shameful. I should choose. Yet sexuality is fluid. Sexuality cannot be defined in this very binary sense of, well, I'm either lesbian or I'm trans or I'm gay. There's no room for that. We've been fighting for that for so long. And here we are within the community creating and giving power to shame through these very fixed ideologies.
I couldn't agree more with that. And again, that is this hierarchy of identity is something that I tackle within my own PhD research. And I think, like you've alluded to, it leads on to lots of other complexities and issues that LGBTQ plus people face. So what are some of these additional complexities?
I think the additional complexities within that environment is feeling, a level of, or not feeling a level, but creating these illusions within our community of to some degree classism, right? And making us feel as if we are unable to access particular spaces because I guess we don't have the currency to venture in that space. So an example would be Monique and I were out and about attending this really cool event, and it was a wonderful event, but the bodies within the room were actually producing elements of shame through how they presented themselves. Other people may have felt inferior to actually step into the space as well, because now, well, I don't have that. Well, I don't know that. Well, I've never done those things, so I have nothing to offer. So that's when it becomes problematic, because then now we're using shame as a mechanism of preventing people from showing up as their true self, where we advocate for this community that is inclusive and, we embrace difference. Yet here we are saying that actually, no, you can't be a part of this crowd. You can't sit with us because you don't have all these things.
Yeah. I actually think some of the complexities that is quite prominent in our community is around mental health, right? And the shame that is produced, that produces a level of mental health and social anxiety and general anxiety disorder within our community and more. We're battling with our identities, we're battling with our sexuality, we're battling with ourselves in and of the world, how we experience the world and how we experienced our families and friends within the world. And then we have to now add another layer to that and work through and kind of navigate and rationalize, how do we work through the entitlement of spaces? We talk about creating queer spaces for Black and brown bodies. We talk about creating, spaces for, you name it, within our queer community, socialized spaces. But then there's entitlement to those spaces. And you think about people from the marginalized community. How do those people experience those spaces? I think shame is so far reaching and not being talked about enough, not being tackled enough, how it produces mental health that is not being addressed, how actually it produces and reproducing a level of ailment even, within our community. Like I genuinely feel like sometimes we have this, we were invited to this event, and this space was an open space that was supposed to be welcoming everyone and supportive. Instead, I didn't feel inadequate, but I can feel others feeling inadequate. You can see the people's body just recoiling when we're supposed to be in a setting talking about intentions, and intentions is such a nourishing dialogue to have. Instead, we started talking about how better the translation was. I'm better. because I'm doing more and I'm more financially secure and I've got this deal with this brand or this deal with this channel. And without knowing it, we are creating an element of shame, right? We are creating also, if I'm not doing that, then what am I doing? This then creates this need to embellish, you know? And then you go home and you feel, oh, I don't feel so good about myself, but I've left this space where I'm supposed to be nourished and filled and feeling loved and accepted. And I've walked away feeling I've just lied about what I'm doing and what I'm not doing because I didn't want to show up in a way that wasn't aligned to everybody else in the room.
You've spoken a bit about it already, but I really want to tease more of it out, the impact that this shame is having on LGBTQ plus people. So what are some of the effects you're observing from this shame?
Anxiety, worry, a lot of performativity, a lot of falseness of selfhood, a lot of confusion. We occupy a world where if you are queer, it is seen as an unhappiness in life. It is seen as almost like you choose to have this death sentence. It's never considered, I guess, in the same way it is to just be heterosexual. It's as if you're punishing yourself. And I think walking through life already with that label and having to challenge many of the labels that are attached to that within just the day-to-day world is already difficult. Then you move into a queer space where the idea here is that we're all equal in one sense of the word, right? So we have our challenges and we have our struggles, but that's the synergy between us. It's the acceptance, it's the space of vulnerability where it's okay to be queer and to come with your pain, because we can all support you and talk about it and share it. But actually, it's almost like this divisiveness, this competition that takes place within that space of now I'm trying to show you how much better I am than you are. But that performativity doesn't just end there. Eventually we become that thing that we're pretending to be. And it can be really unsatisfying because the moment you step out of that space, you know, you go back to this kind of dark and hollow space within yourself, back to that space where you began. Now you're back in that same space as in that you were in the outer world. Now you're in it in this space as well, in your own world. So it's really confusing. It's like, well, who am I supposed to be? The world tells me to be this version. You say that I could be this version in here, but now you're telling me to be just like what the world wants me to be. Now I've got to live up to these standards.
Right. So now we're dealing with a lack of self-esteem, right? You know, your confidence that extends far outside of the queer community and into the workplace, right? Into the streets, into the shops. You know, you have no confidence. It starts to chip away at the person. You know, we've talked about mental health, but actually depression. There are so many people within our LGBT community that suffers with really severe mental health challenges. And instead of working through and looking at ways in how we support each other, we create opportunities to rid someone of their mental health, you know. And these impacts are quite catastrophic to someone's psychological well-being.
We're already alone in the world. Now we're alone again within this space. So it's almost like a double consciousness. You know, I'm trying to fit in here. I'm told I should fit in there, but I don't. So where am I? Where do I go?
And I feel like some of the impact we talk about, we can see some mental health, you can see it. But what about the side that you don't see, like the isolation and the loneliness that this causes?
And I think that speaks to the fact that it doesn't just affect a person's mental well-being, but it has behavioral effects as well in terms of that social withdrawal, that lack of relationship building and community that results from all of this.
Absolutely.
I think we have a lot of work within the, even the spaces that we occupy, let's say the cafes, the clubs, the events. There's almost like a culture that needs to change in how we embrace each other. It feels very much at times competitive. It feels very much at times, if I have, as Mon said, if I have nothing to offer by way of a deal or endorsement, then you have no interest in me. And that for me was an experience at this event that we went, where, you know, we were very much just sort of listening and wanting to offer our intentions. And it was only until I sort of alluded to my psychotherapy work that I became a person in that room, that I materialized, and I materialized for others. They could see me, they wanted to talk to me. But really, it shouldn't be that way. I shouldn't be invisible in a space that says there's room for me.
Yeah, every single person should have value, no matter what monetary or otherwise thing they are bringing to that table.
Absolutely.
And I think this is definitely a question that does not have one answer. It may not have a complete answer that we can even unpack in this space now, but why do these barriers exist for queer and other marginalized folk?
Such a loaded question.
Yeah. It's the big one.
What a loaded question. Oh, wow. Okay, so I think we have to really consider the ontology of all of this, you know, and how did this become to be? I think it's always been a part of our society, you know, more broadly, whether it's in the queer community or otherwise. And there's always been, you know, historically, if you think from as far back as studies will have available, you've come from a bourgeoisie, or, you know, there's always a hierarchy in society, right? And I think you can't ignore what's happening today or in any structure such as the queer community without thinking back of how socially constructed experiences have come to be. So I think it's a very loaded question, and I don't know that there is an answer, but certainly there's socioeconomic drivers to how we behave as humans. I think it depends on your drivers, right? And we feel like the queer community is really big, but it really isn't. And so we come together as a group of people with lots of different layers of intersectionality and differences, right? And if you think about the labels that we attribute to ourselves, my pronoun is she, her. My sexual orientation is a lesbian. And then you then have to go through all the different categories, right? You are trans, you're bisexual, you are transsexual, you're in, I think there's just many that I don't even know, so I'm not even going to call them out. But you see where I'm going with this. We've created structures within our structure that we are now living with the ramifications of that. There is a hierarchy within our structure. There are rules, unwritten rules that we don't speak of, but we abide by those principles. I think it's just something that we don't talk about. We don't disclose shame. When we feel shame, we don't disclose shame, which is one of the biggest way of tackling the feeling of shame, right? If we think about that, the fact that we don't talk about it, but we do know that these structures exist. And when we do talk about it, it's in a very dismissive type of way. But, you know, but we are doing, you know, we are doing well and we're getting better. But are we truly talking about the real behaviors that encourages those constructs within the community? I just don't think we do. And why does it exist? We don't talk about it enough.
I believe that, I agree with all of that. I believe that the problem in the 21st century of shame is nothing to do with queer as it is to do with the human condition. We are absolutely human first before we are anything. And I
absolutely
right. And I think being human means that irrespective of sexual orientation, as Mon said, structures regulate how we understand, how we make sense of things, how we navigate. And that in turn creates the barriers. We are a part of the problem. If we are not talking about an unpacking and being accountable to our contribution of shame and our experiences of shame, how then can we knock down these barriers? You know, we pretend, many of us pretend. Social media for me is this platform where everyone's just pretending. Hey, I'm happy. Hey, I'm doing great.
But also it encourages you to want to show up with as the best version of yourself, as the most put together, most perfect version of yourself. And so that plays a role. It's visibility, right? We now have more visibility. It's not that people were not doing the things that they're doing now. It's not that people, this is not new. What's new is the increase intense visibility into someone's life or a group of people. You know, it's almost like having a window into someone's home, you know, where you think you know a person based on a 30-second snippet of 7 days, right? So because of this intense visibility, we want to show up. We want to show up as the best version of ourselves. And if you don't, then well, you feel a level of shame. You feel a level of guilt for almost. You're almost in this competition with every single person you encounter. Now, you used to maybe be in competition with the girl in high school or the boy in high school who was the most popular boy and he was the only popular boy. Or in the workplace, you have a high performer who you're like, oh, I really want to catch up, you know. Now you're in competition with millions and millions of people that you encounter every single day through social media. So this is not intrinsic to the queer community. However, as a community, I think it's why we should pay more attention to how this is impacting queer people, because queer people don't walk around the world knowing that the world was made up for them. You know, if you're in a heterosexual marriage or a heterosexual relationship, you're expected to walk around holding hands. You're expected to have the house and the family and the everything that comes with that social norm. You know, as a queer person, you are battling with your internal feelings. You're battling with your family. You're battling with your friends. So when you start to have the layers of, you know, layers of shame, layers of complexity to how you then manage that shame, and then you go outside of the world, how do we cope with that? Right? So I think it's important for us to consider that this is not something that's new. It's not something that's, you know, embedded in the queer community, but it does impact the queer community so much more, because we're not just dealing with shame of being, or shame of an experience, or shame of some one linear life choice. It's more around, you know, the choice that you decided to marry somebody of the same orientation, you know, sex, or, you know, so it's such a difficult, I don't think there's one answer, but I do think that it's something that we don't talk about enough, and it's something that we don't pay enough attention to, and it's something that has quite devastating impact to each and every one of us within the community.
Yeah. I also think one of the major barriers is the fear of being alienated if we sort of decide that how we presented ourselves initially is no longer the way that we feel, right? We were talking about this a little while ago, and I was saying to you the idea of anything as a phenomenon to be this thing that we should constantly be curious about, we should constantly question, we should constantly aim to improve it, to enhance it. But that also goes for ourselves. And that's okay, because there is no definitive sexuality. It's never been, it's just never been established. And we do that within the queer community, where we ourselves define bodies. And when that body decides that they no longer feel that way, or something has changed, a shift has occurred, they don't feel safe enough to share, because the moment you do, what happens? The slandering happens, the backlash comes, oh, you weren't really this, oh, you weren't really that, and it makes it so unsafe. Again, the only people putting these barriers up are us. So I also, now that I'm thinking about it a bit more out loud, I'm also thinking, well, how much of this is also rooted in education and understanding history and understanding queer theory and how it works, and going beyond some of the things that the very kind of superficial stuff that we know, right? And really digging into the history of it, so that we can use the history to dismantle the barriers and help people make sense, really educate them, right?
Yeah, I think that was absolutely a critical point, educating from the off that identity is fluid, is not, you know, static, it's not binary. There are so many different aspects of it. And like you said, that you can constantly question and change, and creating those safe spaces to do so. So I guess that leads on nicely to asking for both of you, what does the ideal mental health landscape look like for you? Again, another big question.
Rachel, your questions are very open-ended and loaded.
I'm not. I'm fire at these questions. Wow. The mental health landscape is very much a space, and this is probably one of our favorite conversations. It's rooted in empathy. It's a space that is compassionate, a space that is respectful, and a space that is open to learning, to understanding, to being curious, and to more to the point, accepting that nothing is fixed and some things we'll never perhaps be able to understand. It's not diminishing a person's experience because of our own ignorance, our own sense of lack.
Absolutely. Or there's something that I always say, I don't have to understand someone else's story for it to make sense to me, right? You don't need to understand for something to make sense, right? So if we start there, I think we'll be in a much better place. You know, what does a healthy mental health landscape looks like? I think for me, it's many things. And I think for you, Nayla, it might also be many things as well. And this is something we talk about on a daily basis. We talk about, but what I find really funny, and actually it happens here in the workplace, it happens in our home, it happens in our friendship group. We often assume that we're the only person going through whatever that something is.
Yes, we do. Right?
So we're going through a level of malady and it's just us. I'm the only person going through that. Or I'm the only person, it's worse for me. So there's a level of emotional entitlement to the pain, to the trauma that we go through. And so how we tend to address that as a community, workplace, queer community, home, is we say, oh, let's be compassionate and let's be empathetic. And we use all the, we need better communication. We need to be honest, and we need to be open. And we use all these buzzwords, you know, these trendy words, you know. I remember when every other word was intersectionality, you know. It's almost like we're using buzzwords, but do we actually know what that truly means? Because we say empathy, and then somebody decides, actually, I was a bit confused and I changed my mind. I no longer want to follow this path. I want to follow that path. We say we should extend empathy. And in the same breath, we say, why have you changed your mind? And we berate that person. And we immediately we start to pass judgment. Mm-hmm. So healthy for me is in a place of openness. We remain open, always open, open for the unknown, open for the feeling of being ambiguous. You know, you just don't know. You don't know what you don't know. You're honest, right? We have honest conversations. We don't have, how are you? Well, I'm doing okay, thank you. And, you know, work is amazing. And, you know, this is fantastic. And my relationship is amazing. And my sex life is fantastic. When actually you go, you know, I'm really struggling at the moment. And I haven't really spoken about it. And I haven't really truly been honest about how I'm feeling. So I think openness, honesty, empathy, and empathy from a true place of empathy, where you don't need to understand for something to make sense. You don't need to say, well, now I get it. You don't have to get it. And that's okay, right? Can we have those kind of communities where we show up and you show up as you, your whole self, your whole being? And actually, something that we don't do often enough is, how about we ask for help? You know, we ask for help when we need that help. And I feel like what a healthy mental health landscape looks like is, and I'll give you a story today, and this is not the queer community, but this happens. Somebody breaks down and immediately we want to record it. We want to talk about it with other people. We want to discuss it. We don't lean in and help immediately. You know, I had a situation, I was about to start a meeting and somebody in my team says, I can't come, I'm having a panic attack. I don't need to then publicize that. What I need to do is lean in and help. And that help needs to remain between the two of us. I went off, I helped, I came back, I resumed work. Can we as a community help and support without it being something that needs to be publicized, you know, because that is what feeds into shame. I cannot be open, I cannot disclose, because I am going to be judged. I'm going to be berated. I'm going to then have to live this publicly until something else happened that supersedes this. So for me, it's a stop using buzzwords. Mental health, it isn't trending. This is something that we're dealing with day in, day out. Being queer is difficult, but it doesn't have to be as hard as it is in our community. You know, loving each other in a way that we don't say, oh, you know what I think, Rachel? I really do think when somebody in the queer community says, I love you, you're so wonderful. For me, that's really about performing. And a healthy mental health landscape is that we stop the performance and we truly start to show up organically and authentically.
I love that. I really hope we get there one day. And I think both of you are doing fantastic work within this region. So would you like to share some of that work that you are doing?
Absolutely. So the Love Brunch actually first came about just out of Monique and I wanting to work with diverse communities, bringing them together in a space where we unpack elements of how we can communicate in our relationship to foster better partnership. Another part of that was to, if we could get different bodies with different backgrounds in the room, we could actually help them to see that, believe it or not, you're human first, irrespective of your journey and your background and your experiences. You are human first, we all feel. So we wanted them to leave having a different outlook on when they see other bodies, and to some degree, not judging, but being more compassionate. That then moved into the space of, as I was saying to you, working within a queer space, doing the pop-up therapy workshops, because the other thing that we kept stumbling on were, you know, different bodies approaching us saying, I can't find a therapist, or I've been with this therapist and they were so unhelpful, or I had to keep explaining myself. And a part of the whole mental health landscape is feeling safe enough to go to this space and ask for support and ask for help, and knowing that you really will be received. So our work is helping people to one, see value in themselves. You know, there's a lot of domestic violence within the queer community. And a lot of the time this sort of goes amiss. You know, the services that are in place to pick these things up, they are overwhelmed. You know, many of the charities that work with LGBT QI plus bodies, they're just stretched and they can't always provide enough support and enough resources. So we wanted to just do something, you know, whether it was small, but have an impact and reach different bodies on a monthly basis and just find out how we could be supportive of them. You know, as Mon said, from a space of, well, what do you need? How can we help? This is not about social media. This is not about anything. This is all about you just feeling safe and really being seen, not being invisible. So yeah, so that's what the Love Brunch is all about. And therapy is important. We both believe that therapy is one of those things that we all need. It shouldn't just be when you're in crisis. You should see a therapist just for healing, just to check in, just to make sure that you're okay. In the same way you go and you get the car MOT'd, or you go to the gym, or I don't know, you do something for your body. Therapy is the same thing. And it's helpful because a lot of the time we're walking through life with so much trauma and we're not always aware of it.
We always, one of our, you know, it's creating your own love story, you know, and we always think love story means a fairy tale, you know, the white prince and he comes in on his horse and he comes. And we want to teach and demonstrate ways in which you can foster better partnerships, first of all, with yourself and with the people around you. Understanding, like a lot of what we talked about, accepting differences and extending empathy and really showing respect for the people around you and for yourself. And, you know, we often get lost in our world, and sometimes we need to stop. We need to check ourselves and we need to do some adjustments. And just like an MOT, we talk about, you know, love languages, which again has become a very big, buzzy, trendy topic. But also just the love languages with yourself, because one experience, one encounter, two different experiences, right? And that could be with your partner, that could be with your friend, that could be with a family member, that could be with somebody at work. So what we want to do at the Love Brunch is we really want to help and support in how you foster better partnerships with those people around you, so that we can all have healthier relationships with ourselves and with the people we have in our lives day to day.
And just adding lastly to that, what you said about love languages, which for me is like a massive bone of contention, because context, right? Context. You know, I have a real bee in my bonnet for when I see particular, you know, social media, people holding a social media platform coming on and talking about love languages in this really confident way and not actually giving any context to why a love language is a love language. So instead you've got people who aren't in the know listening to this thinking, well, I'm going to go off now, and because I love designer bags and I love gifts, I'm going to force my partner to buy me gifts, and if they don't that's simple. Far more complex. So that's another reason why we run the workshop, to break these things down so you truly walk away thinking, ah, so my love language came from this. It's not actually about this type of gift.
It's absolutely nothing to do with the designer bag.
I am sabotaging my relationship. Informed.
And I think that's the ultimate message that we want to end on, is just how much education we all need to give ourselves and each other in order to have this ideal landscape and community. So I really want to thank you today for getting into this issue with me. I know that we could have sat here for hours, possibly even days, and still not covered it all. But
I honestly thought, you know, are we even going to be able to cover this topic? Because there is just so much to talk about. So thank you so much. It was great just chatting with you today. But I feel like we could have talked all week.
We could have put the world to right. Is that the saying?
The world to right, yeah.
We've done that today for sure. Yes.
We'll do that off recording. Thank you so much for listening today. New episodes are available every other Wednesday, so please do download, share, and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss a thing. Our topics are designed to be engaging, so if you have any questions or feedback, please do get in touch. You can find us on Instagram at @_overtherainbowpodcast. Our website is www.overtherainbowpod.com, Facebook at @overtherainbowpodcast13, and Twitter at @overrainbowpod. We also have a queer book club, Reading the Rainbow, so if you want to join us in reading the queer universe, please check out our website or Facebook page for more information. Have a queer week, and I'll see you over the rainbow.